copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Good to have you here. This is called There is Power in the Story, How the Stories of the Bible Work in Our Hearts. So if you're expecting something else, feel free to keep looking, but I'm not going to shift from that subject. So that's what we're doing here. And what we're going to think about really is what it says in the title. I lead the Bible Teachers and Preachers Network, and it's tempting to shift in my own thinking to how to preach stories. But actually, that's not what this workshop is focused on. It's how stories work in us. So in the notes, which you probably have on a phone or something somewhere, there's an appendix at the end, 10 pointers for preaching stories. See, I couldn't help myself. I had to put something in there for anyone who ever preaches. And by preaching, I would include talking to children, you know, small group Bible studies. So I would encourage you to read that page, but I'm going to try to resist teaching that page. Okay, because what I want us to focus on is something that is so familiar. We all know the Bible's full of stories, but I want us to think about how do they work? And I want us to do that on two levels. So how do they work in terms of sort of the literature? The story is a certain form of communication, and it does something. And I want us to understand that a little bit. But at the same time, there's a theological question, which is, how does the Bible influence our hearts? And how do Bible stories influence our hearts? And so, as well as thinking about narrative and so on, I want us to think about our hearts and what God is doing in us as we're spending time in the Bible. So hopefully you'll take this and apply it in lots and lots of ways, but I'm going to keep it focused on the Bible story as I'm reading it myself. As you're spending time in the Word in the morning or whenever you do that, you're hearing a Bible story or you're reading it, what's going on there? And maybe understanding a bit of the mechanics of that might even help for that to be more effective. It might be that you can engage even more with Bible stories. I know that for many people, Bible stories are considered sort of consciously or subconsciously as children's material. You know, like when you're in Sunday school, you get the stories, but then when you grow up, you get the epistles. And that's half okay. Getting the epistles is okay, but not getting stories anymore is actually a bit of a disaster, okay? Because God has given us an awful lot of them. How many stories are there in the Bible? Or let me put it this way, how much of the Bible is story? What do you think? Just let's have a little auction.
7%.
How much?
70.
That's quite high, but that's, yeah, not far off at all. In fact, a guy called, what's his name, Rydelnik, I forget his first name, from Moody, he went through and determined what each chapter was predominantly. So that's a slightly arbitrary way to do it. But he's looking at a chapter and saying, is this mostly poetry, or is this mostly story, or is this mostly discourse, direct speech, like an epistle? And he came to the conclusion it was 68% narrative. It's like, wow, that's pretty high. Now, if you do it in other ways of measuring it, you might say, well, it's 45 or 50%. Whatever way you do it, there's more narrative than there is anything else. Okay, we've got the flowing stories of history in Samuel and, you know, books like that. We've got the stories that were told by Jesus a lot, but also Nathan told David a story. And we've got spoken stories, as well as the written history, you know, and all of that is written in narrative, mostly. And so there's an awful lot of it in the Old Testament. Obviously, there's sections of law and so on, but really Genesis, right the way through to, what, Esther, predominantly narrative. And even within the prophets, there are narrative sections or narratives like Jonah. And then you get to the Gospels, and it's either accounts of what Jesus did, which are stories, or stories Jesus told, which are stories. We call them parables. Then the book of Acts, more stories. So there's an awful lot of the Bible that if we say stories are for children, we might as well, you know, get the scissors out, because there's going to be a massive reduction. So hopefully, because you're here, you already believe that we should expect the stories to do something for us. So they are the majority literary type, most common type of biblical material. I put in the notes, they're also what I call the overarching or supra-genre of Scripture. And what I mean by that is this. You have narratives that function in a certain way, and then you also have other types of literature, predominantly poetry and discourse. You can specify different genres within that, but essentially, in terms of literature type, narrative, poetry, discourse. But narrative doesn't end at narrative, does it? When you go into poetry, Psalms, for example, you're getting a snapshot of the emotions of the person who wrote it in the midst of their story. Does that make sense? So, you know, David after the Bathsheba thing, you know, pause. What's going on in his heart? Psalm 51. So it's a poem, but it's part of a story. And in the same way, think about the epistles, the discourse sections. They're all part of a story, right? What's going on in terms of what's Paul going to communicate to that church in the spring of AD 56? I almost said 1956, that was different. In the spring of AD 56, pause. Oh, there's the epistle. And that's what I mean, that actually, the way we can understand stories is so valuable, not just for the 45 to 70% of the Bible that's story, but actually it's going to be helpful for everything we're reading biblically. Because everything has some story sense to it, some aspect of narrative. Now, why are there so many? Why did God, who obviously, as we believe, inspired the Bible, why did he choose to inspire so much of it in narrative form? People tend to ask that, especially if they're engineers, you know, or people that kind of from a background that relates to epistles, you know, and sort of straight, here it is, boom, boom, boom. But actually, why do we have so much story? And the two thoughts that I just put in the notes there are, firstly, because of the nature of God, and this is really the whole answer, what kind of a God do we have? We don't have a God who is distant and far off and throwing commands at us. All right, there's, if you want a holy book like that, there's other options. All right, what we have is a God who, in his very nature, has a tendency towards incarnation, right? If you think about that, it's not just that Jesus had to come into the world to do the dirty job of saving us. You know, it was a necessary evil, but it was totally against the nature of God. That would be completely wrong, wouldn't it? The nature of God as a loving, giving, caring, reaching out kind of a God means that it makes sense that the Son of God would come into our world, even though it makes no sense. Because that's the kind of God that he is. Richard Sibbes, Puritan, back in the 16th century in England, said that if God did not have a certain kind of spreading goodness, then there would have been neither a creation nor a redemption. Everything that God's done flows out of the nature of who he is. And so, because he's a God who incarnates, who moves towards us, think about all through the Old Testament how God placed his presence in the midst of his people. I mean, that's an amazing theme to chase through the Bible. Because that's the kind of God he is, the Son of God coming at the incarnation makes sense, but also the Bible coming to us, all the truth of the Scriptures coming to us dressed up in the flesh of real life just makes sense. It's the kind of book you'd expect from the kind of God that we have. So there's the incarnational nature of God and stories. And maybe this is saying the same thing, but there's the engaging nature of God. God is not a bad communicator. He's not a bad lecturer. Right? If he wants to communicate something, he can do it very effectively. And so when he inspired so much of the Bible to be written down in story form, that was deliberate. There's no mistake. And he did that because he wanted to engage people. Just think about Jesus' ministry. Jesus could have done the most fascinating lectures, couldn't he? You imagine if you went to a conference and Jesus was speaking. And you'd be looking like for the workshop on, you know, creation and the cosmos or something, or, you know, metaphysics or brain surgery. I mean, rocket science, whatever. I imagine he's probably good at all the subjects, if figure that out. But instead, what might you get if Jesus was at a conference? Probably what you get on the Sermon on the Mount. Very engaging material, often in story form. And therefore, the engaging nature of stories, the engaging nature of God, God gives us stories because they are, in some ways, the most effective way to connect with us. And so God's a good communicator with a good motivation, and we should be thankful for that. Okay, so let's just think about stories, or technically narrative, which is the label for what we're talking about. What are the elements? What are the things that kind of constitute a story? I remember when some of my children were younger, obviously they were all younger at some point, but one of my children in particular used to tell me stories that weren't stories. And you might think it's cruel, but I used to tell them that's not actually a story. They say, "Oh, Dad, let me tell you a story from today." And then they'd tell me what happened. And it wasn't a story. And I was like, "You know, I love you, but that's not a story." And they'd look at me, and then I'd explain, and I'd give them a hug, and it was fine. It's not as bad as it sounds. But they would say something like, "So we went to the food shop, and then we came out, and we drove to the library, and then we came home." And I'd say, "Oh, that's cool. That's not a story. If it was a story, you'd come out, and the car would be missing." You know, because stories have something in them that just an account doesn't have. Okay, so what makes a story? This is basic stuff, isn't it? So I'll cover this fairly quickly. There's a setting. Okay, you can't have a story that's in a vacuum. It's got to be on the ground, if you like. It's got to be in the real world somehow. And so all stories begin with sort of an introductory phrase or sentence, if you're in the Bible, or chapter or two, if you're in a novel, kind of setting the background. Okay, and so you've got the setting. Historically, was this during the American Civil War, or was this during the Second World War, or was this, you know, during the 1990s? Like, where does this story fit historically? There's a geographical setting. You can't really tell the story, any story, without rooting it somewhere. Is this in fairyland, or is this in Italy, or is this in, you know, there's got to be some sort of geographical setting, either implicit or explicit. And then there's a situation. You know, it's not just characters existing. There's something, some kind of situation that's going on. And so stories will start with a setting. They also have a narrator, somebody who's telling the story. And so when we're reading scripture, the narrator is very important, but usually invisible. Have you noticed that? Usually the story is told, and you're looking at the story, and you're imagining it like a movie that's playing before you, but you're not watching the person telling it. It's like he's off the stage with a microphone, and he's explaining what's happening. Every now and again, the narrator will step onto the stage and just say, "Oh, by the way," and then give some information. The classic example is the story of David and Bathsheba. Remember that? You read the story, is it chapter 11? You get all the way through it. David has not gone to war. When the kings go to war, he's been on the top. He's seen this beautiful woman. He's called her in. She's got pregnant. He's found out about it. He's tried to kill her, or tried to get, you know, with her husband. Ends up killing her husband. I mean, it's a whole mess. But actually, as you're reading it, he's the Lord's anointed. He's the king of Israel. He's the one that has just received the covenant promise. There's a tension even there in terms of, hang on, is this allowed? Can he do this kind of stuff? And so you get to the end of the chapter and you get this voice that steps forward and says, and the thing that David did displeased the Lord. Thank you. I thought so. I had that hunch, right? But that's a moment where the writer of the story has to be explicit, but usually he's hidden. He just tells the story and on it goes. So we want to be sensitive to the narrator. But typically the setting and the narrator are not the big issues in a story. Certainly Bible stories. Typically the big issues, the things that constitute story or narrative, are characters and plot. It's those two things working together. Okay, so you have characters and you have plot. And both of these things are at work to engage the reader or the listener. And so we're thinking about how do stories in the Bible do something in our hearts. I think this is the core of the issue right here. There's characters in a plot. So let's think about the characters, first of all. Sometimes they are great examples, you know, wonderful people. Sometimes they are great examples of what not to be like, horrible people. The thing about the Bible that's beautiful is that it's very real, isn't it? If you read most histories, the characters that paid for the history to be written are glorious and impressive and powerful and wonderful, and their enemies, who were just their rivals, are absolutely evil. You know, a lot of history has been written that way. And then you read the Bible, and what are the heroes like? They're like David. You know, he had issues. Anyone else in the Bible have issues? Who comes to mind? Abraham, yeah, he kept giving his wife away, which is not a good idea. Yeah, Jacob. My goodness, there's a man who needed counseling. Who else? Samson. Peter, I heard. Samson. We could just keep going, couldn't we?
Judas.
There's an awful lot of very flawed characters, even amongst the heroes. Right? And so there's a reality, there's a power to that. And actually, I kind of think about that in terms of there's something about movies that seem real that's different than movies that are totally an escape. Do you know what I mean by that? Some movies are so fantastical, they're bizarre. They're just like, it's just an escape for 2 hours. You're watching these people fly around and do their thing. But then when you watch a movie and it's believable, it tends to have a lingering effect, doesn't it? The Bible's the ultimate example of that. Real people with real issues, real weaknesses, real failures. They're real people. And therefore, we can connect with them, not as an escape from reality, but in terms of identifying. We tend to identify with people that are real, people that are flawed. Yeah, we may be impressed by superheroes, but we're drawn towards people that are real. And actually, that's right at the heart of how stories work. Because part of the way we're created as humans, in fact, at the core of what we're created as humans, is in the image of God to be relational beings. Now, this might sound silly, but everything the world tells us is that that's not true. Ever since Genesis 3, ever since the serpent said to the woman, "You can be like God. If you eat that fruit in that day, you will know good and evil. You can make your own choices. You can be autonomous. You can be independent. You can be like God, a separate being," which is a total lie about what God was like. All right? But he was offering Satan-like godness. Right? You can be independent like me. Ever since that point where we as humans left the dependent relationship on God, which was perfect and good, and set ourselves up as rivals to God, we've had issues galore, right? There's been problems beyond our understanding. And that's one of the things that I often think about, that even as Christians who've been Christians for years and have read our Bibles for years and have studied and maybe done theology, I'm still convinced we have no idea how powerful the fall is in our lives. It's like a fish in a bowl. You know, it just doesn't know how significant that water is. It's just what it's in. And in our fallenness, there is a corruption of our understanding of God and of self and of everything that's so powerful. You know, so if we go around with the idea, yeah, I needed to be saved because I once stole something. You know, I stole a biscuit, a cookie from the kitchen, and so I'm a sinner, and Jesus died for me. Now my sins are forgiven, and I'm doing okay as long as I don't steal again. That's incredibly thin, isn't it? The reality is we're not saved from the judgment on biscuit stealing. You know, it's not that we fall a little bit short of God's perfect standard. The reality is that we are absolutely corrupt, absolutely bankrupt. We've got nothing of any value to offer to God, and He saves us. And even as saved people, we're still soaked in fallenness. Which means, and this is kind of getting back to my point, which means that we think that we're autonomous, that we stand alone, that we make our own decisions. We think, because the world tells us this, that our life consists in what we own and what we know and how powerful we are and how much influence we have, as if, here's me, oh, here's a better me. You know, I'm going to seminary, I'm educated, it's a better me. Here's me, oh, now I've got money, it's a more powerful me. Oh, I met someone really famous and spoke to them. It's a better me. And we live with this idea that this is me contained, right, by basically what I own, what I know, what I can do, my capacity. And the Bible's telling us, no, you're made in the image of God. You're made in the image of a God who is a father loving a son, and a son responding to the Father by the Spirit in perfect community before anything existed. If you like, before God owned anything, there was a relational reality to who God is and was, right? That's the Trinity. That's the unique God that we have. And we're made in His image. And yet a lot of us act like we're made in the image of other gods that are all about their own strength, power, education, and so on. So if we're made in the image of a relating God, that means that our interpersonal realities are really important. And actually, even though we're fallen and we're sinful and we make a mess of relationships all the time, isn't it true that we have an innate capacity and a desire for relationship? Even if you believe the lie that life is about what you own and the power you can wield, everybody seems to agree that the greatest joys and the greatest sorrows in life are always in the context of relationships. Isn't that true? You know, you work and you sacrifice and you get the car and then you scratch the car and you feel terrible about scratching the car, but you get over it. But when you lose the spouse in order to earn the money to get the car, that marks you forever. When the children don't want to be with you because of the whole car thing or whatever, that's a wound that never fully heals. Because at the core of who we are, we're relators. And we haven't got time to develop this, but at the core of relationship, it's not our brains. It's our hearts. Technically, it's not the pump in our chest. It's our responsiveness to others. Have you noticed that in this specific sense, you are an expert? Okay, you might feel, I don't know, some people come to ELF and feel totally inadequate and, you know, like, well, there's so many clever people here and they feel like they're a total mess. But I tell you, here's a way in which you're an expert. You can interact with another human being with all of the complexity of who they are, and before you have time to think about it, somehow you're either drawn to them or you're repulsed by them. Isn't that true? You don't sit there and think, oh my goodness, I just spent an hour with this person and I'm trying to figure out if I like them or not. Actually, you go to the restaurant and the waiter or the waitress comes over and says, can I get you a drink? And you already know, I like this one. Or, right? It's amazing. I mean, you couldn't invent a computer that could do that. To take in all the factors of a complex human being approaching you at a restaurant. I mean, that's incredible, right? Instantly, I like that restaurant, or I like that waiter, or I like that waitress. I'm attracted to that person. I don't mean just, you know, romantically, just there's an attraction or a repulsion. Sounds too hard, doesn't it? Sometimes we're just a bit, you know, a bit put off somebody. And what goes into that? Is that, did they have to be a certain height? I mean, like, no, because I've got friends that are all sorts of heights and shapes, and it's not a physical attraction thing. As I could tell you what I, you know, find attractive about my wife, which is kind of the model of what I think is an attractive woman, but it's not that. It's something deeper, isn't it? Something about who they are, the way they talk, the way they look at you. Somehow, every one of us is an absolute relational expert, even though we then mess it up. Just give a few more minutes and things will go wrong. But in that initial appraisal, you don't even need to engage the brain. It's already happened at the response level. Does that make sense? Like, not like. Like, very like. Like so much I might marry. You know, there's all sorts of levels of scale on that. But like, not like, like, not like, that's instant within us. We are absolutely experts at it. Why? Because we are created for relationship with humans. Now, you might be the most reclusive person in the world who doesn't get on with anybody, but that's usually evidence of something being broken, isn't it? Because healthy human life is lived out in friendship, relationship, family life, whatever you're blessed to have. That's what constitutes life, because at the core of us, we're not brains. Our brains are merely servants to our hearts. And biblically, if we had the time and if it was a theological workshop, we could go through and we could see that the heart is the dictator in the human, not the brain. Your brain processes and evaluates and rationalizes based on the values given by the heart. Which is why when you walk through the line to get the food here, you're able to rationalize why you've ignored all of those many, many versions of sprout. Onion sprouts I saw yesterday. I was like, wow, who would take onion sprouts? Because for me, that's like, ooh. And yet, even in all my desire to be healthy, because I really want those little white flowery things with sugar on the top with some Nutella, you know, I'm going to rationalize why I have that, but it's not because my brain's in charge, it's because my heart's in charge and I really like them, right? And other times I do take some sprouts, not the onion ones, that's a bit weird, but I do take sprouts. Why? Because I know those are incredibly healthy. That's not a no thing, it's a I love to be healthy. And so we do what we want. We're want-driven creatures. And that shows itself more than in anything else in our response to humans. So come back to the idea of a narrative. What happens when you start reading a narrative or hearing a Bible story? As soon as there's enough information to start to paint a picture of a person, you're drawn to them. Or you pull away from them. You either like them or you don't. You either want them to succeed or you want them to fail. Isn't that true? It's certainly true with movies, isn't it? I remember years ago, this is kind of a silly and slightly pointless story, so I'll keep it short. But I remember years ago, my friend and I decided to watch this film. I think we bought it cheap. It was a terrible film. It was called L.A. Street Fighters. All right, so you can imagine, you've already probably figured out the whole plot. But we're sat there, and as the film started, within 2 minutes, he said, all right, I'll be him, you be him. Now you might think, well, how does that work? But that was just a very 12-year-old way of relating to a film. Right? Already seen two guys in this film. They're obviously going to be fighting someone somewhere. And so it's going to be interesting to see who wins the fight. And so we're two 12-year-old boys. I'll be him, you be him. I said, that sounds fine by me. 10 minutes later, his character died. Now, I don't want to celebrate death, but that was pretty funny. Right? Because start of a film, you expect an hour and a half of character. And his was an extra, mine was the hero. So I was like, okay, that's it, I win. But isn't that, in a 12-year-old childish way, what we do with every film we watch? I like that person, or I don't like that person. I want that person to succeed, or I want that person to fail. And you know, it's so powerful with movies that you can be watching something, that is absolutely opposed to everything you believe, and what do you find yourself doing? Wanting, cheering, hoping that that poor man can have that affair with that beautiful woman because it's just so romantic. Now, press pause and stop and have a little conversation about your view of marriage. You'd say, oh no, affairs are completely wrong. You know, he should go back to his wife. But when you're watching it, you're gripped, aren't you? And don't you ever find yourself kind of, I probably shouldn't watch this because I'm so drawn in. I'm already wanting something to happen that I know shouldn't. That's the power of a story. It's not a case study of, oh, look what happens between humans. We're walking in their shoes. We're walking alongside them. We're feeling the story because stories don't just convey information. They grip us at the heart level. And so as you read a Bible story, the characters in it, even with very little information, will either draw you towards them or push you away in some way. So identification is a massive reason that Bible stories affect us. I suspect you don't like Jezebel. Mm-hmm. Right? The Bible's pretty good at painting her a certain way. We did a Bible study recently, not the latest one, but a few months ago, and we're looking at Judas in John 13 and the whole Judas story. And it was interesting to see people suddenly for the first time go, hang on a minute, I almost feel sorry for him. You know, because the normal response is, boo, Judas, don't like him. But spending a bit of time wrestling with the text, there were people that are going, oh, I feel sorry for him, but I don't think I should. And there was a wrestling going on. Stories engage us. Doesn't matter how intelligent we are, doesn't matter how sophisticated we are, when there's a good story, people are drawn into it. Preachers know this, by the way, some of them. When they're lecturing and, you know, giving information and the crowd's starting to kind of do this, or starting to shuffle and get a bit distracted, a lot of us as preachers realize, I need to get them back. Let me tell you a story. And suddenly everyone stops moving and leans forward. Because there's a power in a story. So, characters and our identification with them is going on in the Bible. That's part of the way the thing is working. The other part of it is the plot. A plot is characters' intention. Characters in a situation where something is unresolved. So on the notes, I gave this standard plot line. Maybe you've seen one of those in an English or German or whatever class in the past, where you kind of have a story and it rises and then it resolves. And so the sequence there is very simple. There's a setting. There's no tension yet, just a setting. But then a tension's created. Now you want to know what's going to happen. The tension increases. It doesn't resolve quickly. And then eventually it gets resolved. And then the story unwinds pretty fast. Does that seem fairly familiar? You see it every single TV show you watch, every crime drama. It's incredible. They churn those things out. They're all identical, aren't they? And yet people watch them week after week after week. Why? Because you're gripped. You're gripped as soon as there's a problem. Add the fact that you've identified with the characters and you'll watch the next episode, even though you know what's going to happen. Right? You like him, you don't like her, whatever. You're gripped. And so TV show story, very simple. I'll spoil every one of them for you right now. Starts at 9 p.m. Okay, let's have the woman in the car with the bags in America, paper bags of groceries. Europeans find the paper bags amusing sometimes. So groceries in the back. She drives home, pulls onto her driveway. Are you gripped yet? No, something's got to happen fast or else you're turning over. Okay, so she takes the bags out of the car, gets to the front door, opens the front door, walks in, and what meets her? Her husband's body, right? Pinned to the wall with a samurai sword. Blood everywhere, he's clearly dead. She drops the bags. I think that's a good thing with paper bags because they rip in a moment of tension. So the bag drops, there's milk on the floor, she screams. Now they can run the credits. Because you're gripped. You want to know who would kill her husband with a samurai sword? That's weird. Okay, so then maybe I don't want to be unhelpful in terms of my gender references, but I'll let you ladies off here and say at least the men As we're watching that, one thing we tend to do is think, I'm going to solve this. I think ladies are just a bit more sophisticated. We're dumb enough to think we can. All right, so you start watching, the credits are finished, the detectives are there, and they're talking, and within 2 minutes, there's a lead. Has your husband had a fight with anyone recently? No, everyone loves my husband. Oh, wait, there was this one person. All right, what happened? Well, I only heard part of the argument, but he was shouting at my husband, and my husband was kind of getting upset about it. Oh, what did you hear? I heard something about, I'm kind of making this up, help me out here, samurais. Okay, so here's where the men get really clever. We go, got it, it's him. I should be a detective, right? It was clearly the guy who was arguing about samurais with the husband who's dead with the samurai sword. So you continue watching, waiting for them to catch up with your brilliance. And what happens? 10 minutes later, they've got the guy in questioning, and he's got a perfect alibi because he was at the samurai arts display in town. And then you feel a bit deflated because you think, oh man, I thought I was good at this. And then somewhere between 10:30 and 10:50, there's going to be new information that you never had at the start, so there's no way you were ever going to get it, by the way. But there's new information that comes out, and then there's a new lead, and just when you think it's that person, it's not. But his brother is, you know, a known samurai assassin type, or whatever it is, and you go, oh, amazing. And then it's resolved because he's arrested, and the thing finishes really fast. Usually the detectives kind of, you know, patting each other on the back, or the police officers changing into normal clothes, and it's done. There's not much story to tell, you know, hopefully, in the locker room. That's a story that repeats week after week after week on every channel, and people pay millions to advertise in the breaks because they know millions will be watching. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Man, I feel guilty for the time I've wasted learning that stuff. So that's how stories work. What about Bible stories? Same thing. It's going to be a setting, there's going to be a tension. The tension isn't going to resolve instantly, but once it does resolve, you're going to go, oh, and then it's going to finish and move on. That's the nature of a story. Sometimes they don't resolve instantly, they go into another tension. So, for example, setting. There was a man who had two sons. Interesting. Not gripping. You know, there's lots of men with two sons, but okay, that's the setting. And the younger son came to him and said, Father, give me all that's coming to me. Ooh, you can't do that. Who does he think he is? That's completely out of order. Now he's shamed his father. Is he going to slap him? Put him in his place? Tell him to stop? Go home, get some work? You know, you're just like your mother. Like, what's he going to say to this child? He gives him what's coming to him. Whew, wasn't expecting that. And the son goes off and takes everything pretty quickly, fire sale. He would have sold resources, assets. He was gone. He's gone away into the far country. End of story. That would be a rubbish story, wouldn't it? Because it's got to be resolved. And so he goes off and he's hiring himself out after all the money's disappeared, because that adds to the tension. He had money, at least. Now he hasn't even got money. So he hires himself out and he's in the field feeding the pigs. And he's so hungry, he wants to eat what the pigs are eating. So if you're Jewish, you go, oh, that's gross. And he wants to eat pig food. But the person who's hired him said, hey, you work for me for room and board, but there's no board, just room. So he's got a place to sleep, but no food. And he's starving to death in this famine that's happening. I mean, you feel the tension rising, right? Just tension, tension. There's famine, there's loss of money, there's working with pigs, that's gross. And eventually he comes to himself. Is that the resolution point? I don't think so. He comes to himself and he has a plan. I can go to my father and I can say to him, after all, my dad's workers get paid properly. Important fact. So if I go to my father and I say to him, I've sinned against heaven and before you, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, make me one of your hired men. I could get a job. I think that's honestly what's going on there. And so he comes home in order to get a job, to earn money, to pay off his debt, to resolve the problem and keep himself free from his father. Or to earn money to leave and go away and live the life again that he wanted. So how is this tension going to be resolved? Because it's not resolved by him coming back. How is it resolved? It's not resolved by him. It's resolved by his father. His His father's looking for him. He runs to him. He humiliates himself in front of all the villagers, falls on his neck and showers him with blessings, or just credit cards and rings and shoes and stuff, right? And he just blesses his son ridiculously. And the son doesn't finish his speech. He says, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." And if he was going to say something else, I don't think he would say, "Give me a job." I think at that point he would say, "What are you doing? What's all this? What are you doing? Why are you being so gracious?" And so he's brought back in and he's there and they're partying and they're celebrating and the music's playing and the credits start to roll and you go, that was a great story. Oh wait, there's seven more verses. Because there's an older brother. And he's been out in the field and he comes in and he hears the music and he asks one of the young boys, "What's going on?" "Your brother's come home. He was lost and he's found. Woo, they're partying to celebrate." And he is angry. And instead of coming in and being with the father and sitting at his side and leading the party, which would have been his role as the older son, being sort of the host of everything, he stood outside with his arms crossed and his face like thunder. And everyone knows it, and the father knows it, and the question is, what's the father going to do now? He's being shamed by his son. And so the father could save face and get him dragged in, or, you know, just do something to him, laugh it off. But no, the father goes out and he begs him. I think he kneels down maybe in front of him, just pleads with him to come in to that party. And the son's angry. "All these years I've worked for you and you haven't even given me a goat so that I could go and party with my friends. But when this son of yours who spent everything on prostitutes comes back, you kill the fattened calf for him." He's angry and he thinks that somehow he deserves something and that one doesn't. And the father pleads with him and says, "Look, everything that I have is yours. I'm always with you." And there's this plea and it's left hanging. Now, what is that for a plot line? Man had two sons. "Give me everything that's coming to me." That's tension. He goes away, famine, etc. Pigs, oh my goodness, it's getting worse. He's coming home. Is he going to get a job? That's weird. What's going to happen? And then the father shows astonishing grace. Whew, that's amazing. And just as it's starting to resolve, the older brother shames the father. Tension. And then they argue, if you like. They talk it through. And the tension rises, and the father's begging him. And will that demonstration of grace win the older son's heart? Chapter 16, new story. And you go, hang on a second. That's really annoying. That's like one of those artsy films that doesn't have an ending. You know, some people love them. I just get annoyed. I think, what's that? Come on, finish the job. But actually, it's powerful, isn't it? Because it leaves you hanging. It leaves you thinking, what's going to happen? Will the older son respond like the younger son? Will he come in, or will he not? And actually, Luke does resolve it, doesn't it? By the end of the gospel, we know that that older son, who represents the Pharisees and the religious leaders, that older son effectively takes the astonishingly amazing grace that's demonstrated to him, picks it up, and nails it to a cross to reject it. That's the response of the religious to the amazing grace of God demonstrated in Christ. And Luke 15 setting that up. It's powerful, isn't it? And so when you're preaching it and talking about it and thinking about it or pondering it, you kind of have to ask yourself, well, clearly the Father is like God or Jesus or something, right? Am I like the younger brother or am I like the older brother? Because I think as you go through that story and you imagine it, somehow your heart is leaning in towards one of them. You might say, oh wow, I have been just like that younger brother. The things I've done, the places I've been, the regrets I have. My goodness, that's me. It's like that's me in the story. And the grace of God just grips you and thrills you and does something. Why? Because there's that heart connection. Or you might read it and go, you know what, I feel sorry for the older brother because I can totally relate to that. I've been good and I haven't received what I deserve. Whew, hang on. Isn't it easy to sound like a Pharisee? Isn't it easy for that older brother to rise up within us? And I think the power of that story is two things. One, I connect to both. How about you? In some way, don't you see that a little bit of both brothers in your own life? And yet the grace of God is shown, the humiliation of the grace of God is shown towards both. But the real power is that it's not resolved and it's left hanging, and it leaves you with this question: how will I respond? How do I respond to the grace of God shown to me? So you see, the plot in that case is a rising tension resolved and into another tension unresolved. It's a bit more complicated, but the real issue is still the same. It's characters in tension, characters in a plot. But those characters are somehow so believable. Even if you've never lived in a village in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, which I suspect you haven't, even so, you can relate to that. The rebellion or the self-righteousness. That's the way a story's working. By identification that draws us in through the tension so that we walk with them. It's almost like in the screen that is inside our hearts, the movie is forming as our imaginers are turned back on again, and we can imagine it and we can see the characters, but eventually you kind of get a bit confused because you start seeing your face instead of theirs. Do you see what I mean? It's not just a fascinating case study. It's speaking to us. And so that's how Bible stories are working. And so when I get to the next page in the notes, I say, okay, so what do we do to that? How do we preach the stories to our own hearts? Hear and feel the story. Slow down enough to allow the images to start to form. When you're reading through a story, don't just race past it at a million miles an hour, but slow down and picture it in your mind. Maybe you can picture it naturally. Your mind goes to sort of a Middle Eastern scene and you can imagine that setting. Great, watch that movie. Maybe you automatically put it into today's terms. That can work too. You just got to be a bit careful. But however it is that you see it, let the text be informing what you're seeing. And actually, I think that's what's so powerful about the Bible, is that we slow down and we notice details. Every time we come back around to the same story, we see and we feel the difference and the little nuances. And, oh, I never noticed that before. Oh, that's interesting. And the story, the movie that we're watching, becomes clearer and clearer in our own hearts. And I said on the notes there, trust the storyteller. What I mean by that is every word is there on purpose. Every detail's there for a reason. Okay, it's not just there as an aside. It's there to move you forward within the story. Classic example. I suppose I just preached this recently. Zacchaeus. Remember the story of Zacchaeus? Jesus was passing through Jericho. Okay. There was a man who wanted to see him. His name was Zacchaeus. Not gripped yet. But then we get some detail. He was a tax collector. Ooh, this is getting juicy. Chief tax collector. He was rich, you don't say. And he was short. Ooh. That's an interesting detail. Now you might go, I totally relate to that. I'm a tax collector and I'm really short. Or you might be like me and think, I'm neither a tax collector and I've never been short. Whatever, but it's now a real person, right? You can start to imagine him. He's short, he can't see Jesus, he's ridiculously rich. How has he got rich? Basically by stealing from his people. So there's a tension here. What's going to happen? Perfect Jesus, nasty little Zacchaeus. And so Zacchaeus is so desperate to see Jesus that he runs on ahead. It's helpful to have some cultural awareness, and that's where over time the Bible becomes more and more colorful to us. Middle Eastern men don't run. That's not normal. And so for the father to run to the son is a very important detail in Luke 15. For Zacchaeus to run on ahead is very important because it means lifting up the skirts of what he's wearing, bared his legs like his knees are showing. It's very humiliating, but he really, really, really wants to see Jesus, and he's running. So much so he climbs up a tree, which I imagine is difficult in a skirt, right? So he climbs up a tree and he's hiding in this tree, and Jesus is coming along. And if you know, at that moment, if the phone rings, do you go, oh, well, I don't care? You go, oh, I want to know what happens. You're gripped because there's a tension. And so Jesus comes along and Jesus looks up and he looks and he points and he calls his name and the tension goes through the roof like, oh my goodness. Because here's an interesting thing that if you ponder it enough, you get more and more details coming to life. You might say, well, hang on a second. If running and climbing is so radical for a Middle Eastern man, why doesn't he do the obvious? Push through the crowd. All right, kids know that. They don't have to go to school to learn that. If there's a crowd and there's a procession, they push through. They get to the front. They get the best seats in the house, right? Why doesn't Zacchaeus act like most children? Any thoughts?
They didn't want to be seen.
He didn't want to be seen. They wouldn't let him. So he doesn't want to kind of make a thing of himself, partially because of the tension with the people. They're not going to let him. Zacchaeus is behind you. Don't let him see. You know, they're going to kind of lock themselves out a bit. And if he pushes his way through the people he's been stealing money from, what do you think they're going to do? It's not a children's Bible story here. This is reality. What do you think they would have done? I think they'd stab him. Honestly, Jericho's full of fruit farmers. They'd all have little pen knives for, you know, cutting fruit off trees and stuff. I think they would go, oops. You know, job done, and little Zacchaeus in a pool of blood. I mean, they don't put that in the kids' Bible stories. Maybe that's a thought for the future, William. But there he would be lying in a pool of blood, and he probably wasn't planning that. So he ran on ahead and he climbed a tree, which means he does not want to be seen, which means when Jesus gets there, because he'd be hiding in the tree, wouldn't be like, woo, you know, waving at Jesus. He's hiding in the tree and Jesus points up and says, Zacchaeus! What does the crowd do now? Maybe laugh.
They all see him.
They all see him. They know where he is. Zacchaeus is in a tree. Right, let's go home. Not likely. Zacchaeus is in a tree. I've got to see this. And a crowd gathers. And what begins as ha ha ha, what does that turn into when there's hatred in the heart? It becomes angry. Put yourself the wrong end of a football stadium wearing the wrong color and watch what happens. A crowd acts in a way that individuals often don't. It's frightening. And so Zacchaeus would have been in that tree, exposed by Jesus, with an angry crowd ready to rip him to bits, but Jesus gets to speak first because he's the guest. And so Jesus says to Zacchaeus, you evil man, I'm going to give you what you deserve. No, wait, I should read my Bible. He doesn't do that, does he? Jesus says, hey, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm coming to your house today. Cultural significance? In England, we don't invite ourselves to each other's houses. That's kind of rude. Is Jesus being rude here? He's honoring him. I'm going to have fellowship with you, Zach, you and me. All right, we're going to eat onion sprouts together. We're going to have a special moment. All right? And so what does Zacchaeus do? Anyone remember in the passage? Every detail's important. So he came down quickly. And they left. Now, I think the reason they left and the reason he came down quickly is because he was trying to get away before the crowd started kicking him. Right? This is a tense situation. But we get an important detail in the story. In verse 7, it tells us, so the crowd began to grumble. And the word grumble there, if we were to do a little bit of study in the Greek, it's this kind of low rising anger. It's starting off like a, but it's becoming, you know, it's coming up. There's a rising tension in that crowd. And who are they angry with? The clue is what it says next. He has gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. You see why Zacchaeus wanted to get away? Because this is an angry crowd. And the reason he can get away is because Jesus has redirected their anger onto himself. Jesus is a rescuer. It's an amazing moment. If you imagine that later on, I challenge you, maybe when you go to bed or at some point, read through those 10 verses and read it slowly and imagine what that would have been like. The crowd is angry at Jesus. And so they go back to the house. Next verse, Zacchaeus stands up and he says, half my money I give to the poor, and if I've stolen anything from anyone, I pay him back four times as much. And then Jesus says, woo, impressive. See, This man too is a son of Israel. And you go, or son of Abraham. Well, what? Hang on a second, Jesus, you're giving him credit for giving money away? I thought we didn't earn our salvation. No. He's not earning his salvation, he's responding to it. He was saved at the tree. That's where the grace was shown. That's where the life was transformed. And what does it look like? Look at verse 8. Give away, give away, give away. And then Jesus says, he's one of us. He's really in the family. And then you get the punchline, verse 10. After you've got this whole story setting up the fact that Zacchaeus was wanting to see Jesus, and so he ran and he climbed and he's desperate and all of that stuff, then you discover that the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Oh, hang on a second, I've got to rethink the story now, because I thought Zacchaeus was the seeker. Turns out Jesus is. You could have an amazing half an hour just reading those 10 verses and imagining it and sort of putting yourself into the scene and thinking, Lord, what would I have done? Actually, who do I relate to? Am I like Zacchaeus? Do I deserve anger against me? Have I betrayed others? Have I hurt people? Have I sinned against you, Lord? Am I a disgrace, actually, to you? Actually, I kind of am. Do I deserve judgment and anger? Yes, I do. Have you come and sought? Have you come and rescued me? Yes, you have. And you could have a wonderful quiet time just pondering and telling and retelling that story to yourself. And the more the details filter up, the more color is added, the richer it gets. And your heart just warms up to Jesus, which is kind of a good thing, right? And you go, wow. Man, someone should write a song about amazing grace, because, oh wait, there is one. Maybe you'll even sing because of spending time in just a children's story. You see the power of that? It comes as we trust the storyteller and we say, okay, every detail matters. I'm turning on my imagination. I'm pondering it. I'm imagining it. I'm reimagining it. I'm telling it to myself. I'm retelling it to myself. And as I'm praying and asking God to work in me, my heart is gripped by the story and I'm changed by it. Luke, chapter before, Luke 18. This is short, okay? When you despair because of... ever started a book and not finished it? Welcome to the club. Here's a story you can't fail to finish. It's really short. So verse 9, Jesus told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. So you even know what the point is already. Here's the story. Two men went up into the temple to pray. Are you interested yet? Like, are you gripped? Come on, two men go to the temple. Woo! Okay, let's keep trying. One of them's a Pharisee and the other's a tax collector. That's better, right? Okay, so now what are we feeling? What's going to happen here?
They'll get into a fight.
Sure, yeah. So you and me, we should watch LA Street Fighters. Like, come on, let's have some violence. Okay, so they're going to get into a fight. Why? Because the Pharisee is what? What would you call a Pharisee? Good? Bad? You have to think about it, because we think bad, don't we? Because they killed Jesus. But actually...
He's a holy man and a real patriarch.
Oh, yeah. He's a hero. Like, if a Pharisee walks past, you go, woo, that's good. All right, this is a good man, impressive man by human standards. And a tax collector? Good or bad? I've just told you with Zacchaeus, we're supposed to not like them. The problem is, we tend to not like Pharisees and like tax collectors. So we're confused already. All right, tax collectors, well, there's that cool guy that climbed trees. All right, and what else? I don't know. Jesus was a friend of tax collectors. They must be good people. Actually, tax collectors were hated. And the Pharisees were loved or revered. And so there's going to be a tension. This is like two opposites. And so there's a tension. What's going to happen? So the Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. That's a bit harsh, isn't it? You know, even him. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I get. Now, we could spend time in that and think, and he's saying he goes way above and beyond what any Jew is expected to do. The law requires fasting once a year. He fasts twice a week. The law demands tithing, but not of everything that you get. That's double tithing. That's like tithing in case somebody else forgot to tithe. That's like hyper tithing. This guy's a super overachiever. And he's not like all these other people, which is true, especially the tax. You probably maybe feel a bit of tension, like that does sound a little bit arrogant. But technically, it may be true. And then you get the tax collector standing far off. He would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but he beat his breast, banging his fists against his chest, which actually is kind of a woman at a funeral thing to do in that culture. But he's saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Okay, there's a prayer meeting. There's the arrogant prayer. And there's the, I need help. God, I'm such a sinner. What's going to happen? When do they fight? Actually, they don't fight, sorry. But the resolution comes in verse 14. The resolution is a shock. If you try to get yourself into that setting, man, I wonder if God would be merciful to that sinner so that he could be part of the people of God like the Pharisee. Jesus says, I tell you, this man, the tax collector, went down to his house justified. Oh, good. Praise the Lord. Rather than the other. No. Are you serious, Jesus? That's like a punch in the stomach. That's like the older brother's not in the family. Like, he's a sinner too. That's like really an amazing thought. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Whoa, I need to think about that. Lord, I'm praying about this because I find myself thinking during that story, you know, that Pharisee, he's a good chap, but he's not. I wonder if people think that of me and I'm not. You know, you go into it and you start identifying and you start pondering and you start wrestling, and the story does something in you. That story right there, those six verses, could do more in your life than an entire novel you could buy in the airport. That's how powerful this stuff is. Okay, I'm very conscious of the time and so much more we could say, but what I'd encourage you to do is not just skim past Bible stories, but instead slow down, read them again, try to fill in some of the cultural stuff with anything you know, and you know, guess if you don't, you can always research and find out more later, but do what you can, figure out what you can, turn on your imagination station, right? Just get the remote control and go, right, on, my imagination's working, and then talk to God as you ponder the story, and as you find yourself identifying with characters and feeling the tensions of the plot and seeing God doing his miraculous transformation of people, you'll find that he's doing it in you without even realizing it. So, final comment as we're finishing is just stay anchored in the text so that your imagination is really fueled by what's there. But don't have your blinkers on so that you're only in one text. Keep flowing. Let the stories build on each other. And you'll start to see there's a richness there that is absolutely glorious. Okay, our time is up. Thank you. Yeah, write a story about how well this went.